Welcome to the Solari Food Series audiocast. This is your host, Pete Kennedy. It's great to have John Moody back on the audiocast today for part three of our series on homesteading. With a further breakdown in supply chains and the continued growth of inflation and food prices since John was last on in the spring, it seems like this program is more timely than ever. John is a farmer, homesteader, speaker, and author of such books as The Frugal Homesteader and The Elderberry Book. He is also the co-founder and manager of the Rogue Food Conference. So, John, great to have you back on the Food Series audiocast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Pete.
Okay, so we're going to pick up, I think, with foraging. So if you could give the listeners your thoughts on that, foods to look for, foods to avoid, the floor is yours.
Yeah, so do you want to real quick touch on what's going on with the agricultural shortages issue?
Yeah, let's do that to get people primed for what you have to say after. So, yeah.
So have you been following the fertilizer shortage issue?
Yes.
You know, so I just want listeners to kind of understand, you know, a lot of us a year and a half ago, were warning that the way they were handling coronavirus with lockdowns, all these really crazy, unprecedented measures, we're going to have a long, you know, a multi-year horizon of cascading negative impacts across different sectors of the economy and supply chains and stuff. And now we're like really deep into some of these things beginning to spiral out of control. So take fertilizer. Right now, fertilizer prices have gone up tenfold in some parts of the world, a 1,000% increase in fertilizer prices. In some parts of the world, the price increases are so great that the companies that make fertilizer have closed down operations because they cannot get the petroleum-based inputs they use to make, you know, synthetic nitrogen fertilizers out of. So a number of my friends in the agricultural space say that they're not saying this too much publicly at the moment because it would cause so much stress and people losing their minds. But there might be as much as a 30% shortfall for fertilizer next year. So yeah, it's substantial to say the least. And then on top of that, I have a friend who is a fabricator at a large agricultural company that makes large-scale agricultural equipment. I believe he works on the boom sprayers, if you're familiar with what those are.
Right.
And his company alone has over 200 of these boom sprayers that are sitting on a lot down the road from the company because they cannot get the pieces to finish them.
Right.
So what we are possibly looking at in 2022 into 2023 is a possible perfect storm of human stupidity causing an unprecedented decline in agricultural output.
Right.
AKA, you know, at the very least in America, I'm planning to see another 10 to 15% increase in food inflation. And that would be, in my mind, a best case scenario for next year.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, with this mandate craziness too, they already have, if you look at California, what's going on there, they have so many rules for the ports, these specialized rules that, yeah, it's impossible. It just puts a real crimp trying to follow all these rules. And then, you know, with the mandates and people in critical industries not wanting to get the jab, it just further backs things up. So it's.
Yeah. And so we have fertilizer shortages. We have labor shortages because of the mandates. Somebody on Twitter who says they work in the poultry processing industry says they're already running a inspector shortage for inspecting the USDA plants. I'll send this to you. This will be right up your alley, Pete.
Mm-hmm.
And with the mandate coming for federal workers, I believe it might be December 4th, if as many inspectors quit as are forecasted because they will not comply with the mandate, the already shorted number of inspectors is going to suddenly balloon.
Right.
And they're going to have to scale back how many animals they can push through the system. We might be back to where we were a year and a half ago with them euthanizing off animals.
The other thing is, a year and a half ago, they actually relaxed some of the USDA and FDA regulations when they had this, some of the big slaughterhouses shut down. That might not be a bad idea. Again, I mean, we'd all like to see the PRIME Act pass, but this could be a test run, just maybe whether it's letting the state inspected facilities ship across state lines or even trying to have some of these custom houses just process for intrastate commerce, like Representative Tom Massey is advocating for. There's, like you said, I think the deadline for these inspectors is actually November 22nd. That was the last deadline I saw. So it's coming. But okay.
Yeah. Yes, I just want listeners to have a really good understanding of the number of negative things that are affecting the agricultural sector. Equipment shortages, part shortages, fertilizer shortages, labor shortages, processing bottlenecks. And all of that is beginning to really stack. And next year may be when we really, really feel all of that begin to hit. And then if we have any adverse weather issues next year, it could be a complete clown show.
Well, yeah, John, I think I saw one story the other week where someone who produced fava beans didn't have his, he had one big market for it, and he lost that market because the purchaser was out of packaging equipment. So
I guess that'd be another thing to add to the list is, packaging and material shortages for even if you can produce it, if you can't process it and then package it.
Right. You're out of luck.
So a company that we work with for our buying club, it's a local kombucha business. And they always did kombucha in these 16-ounce glass bottles. And the glass bottles have gone up so much in price, and they became so hard to get your hands on that they actually are moving to 12-ounce metal cans, even though it costs them, probably five digits of retooling their business, this small business. It was just cheaper for them to completely retool the entire business and production because of the packaging shortages.
Right. Yeah, it's a shame. But okay, so that intro was to encourage you to grow as much of your food as possible. So, John, yeah, let's get started with foraging. Your comments on that.
Yeah. So I like foraging. The thing I always tell people up front is cultures historically that were really well known for foraging, they actually were not foragers in the modern sense. They basically were engaging in permaculture over many generations, where they would steward large-scale landscapes in such a way as to make them easily forageable. So they were constantly planting nut trees and fruit trees and noticing species that had high caloric value and ripping out unproductive species and encouraging highly productive species, which is why they could forage such a large percent of their calories from their ecosystems. Most modern ecosystems, especially in America, are degraded ecosystems. Their forage potential is much, much lower than it could be. And therefore, your return on calories, your ROC, can be really poor in a foraging situation. If you want to get more into foraging, you need to be in an area that has landscapes that actually make foraging make return on energy, return on calorie make sense. So that's the first thing I always tell people when foraging. I love foraging. Foraged foods have a lot of potential, but in many parts of the country, foraging is not an effective survival strategy.
Mm-hmm. So in your particular neck of the woods, when you moved in there, were the wild plants, I mean, was it something where you had to plant a number of trees yourself, or was there some foraging potential right there from the beginning with what was in the wild?
Our farm has foraging potential, but it's really quite low. We have some wild elderberry plants, some wild berry plants, but this might give a good idea of the difference of return on energy and return on calories. If we were to harvest all of our wild elderberries, it would take about 10 times as much time as harvesting the handful of cultivated plants we planted, and we would get 10 times less elderberries.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 100-to-1 difference, cultivated versus wild. Now, that's not true everywhere. I'm just pointing out that we want to create highly forageable landscapes, and we can no longer assume that we live in a landscape where forage potential is going to be high and actually make sense.
Right. What about as far, obviously, some plants you want to stay away from when you're foraging, certain mushrooms, other plants. Yeah, what's your advice on that? Or are there any particular sources you recommend to get people to tell the difference?
Pete, all mushrooms are edible.
Okay.
Some mushrooms are only edible once.
Right. Okay. Right.
So if you want to get into foraging, the first thing you should get are some of Samuel Thayer's books. So he has 4 or 5 books on foraging in North America. So he has Forager's Harvest and other ones. Abby, are some of these sitting out in here or are they back? Just any of the Thayer's foraging books. So Thayer's books are widely considered the best reference books, on foraging. Nature's Garden, A Guide to Identifying, Harvesting, and Preparing Edible Wild Plants. The Forager's Harvest, A Guide to Identifying, Harvesting, and Preparing Edible Wild Plants. So his books, absolutely fabulous. But the other big thing you want to do if you want to get into foraging is you want to find someone local to you who does foraging, and you want to begin to go do this with them. Because the fact is, North America alone has probably 20 or 30,000 edible plants. But tons and tons of them only occur in certain parts of the country. Take wild rice. Wild rice only grows in limited regions of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't grow where I am. But persimmons grow where we are, but don't grow in other parts of the country. Now, elderberries grow everywhere pretty much. And so foraging is probably 60 to 80% location-specific skill set. So you really want to find someone in your region, in your location, who can help you learn and apply this skill set prudently to where you actually are.
Okay.
Because the forageable plants in Florida are going to look and generally be completely different than the forageable plants in Minnesota.
Right. You know, we opened up by talking on the shortage of, just the agricultural shortages that we're looking at right now. Just, I think another thing that has really alarmed people the last 20 months is the state of our medical system right now. Just trying, I think when we see some of the things that are happening with the hospitals, how they've gotten COVID-centric, it's more incentive than ever to try and, just take responsibility for our healthcare however we can. I mean, one way for the homesteader, obviously, is growing the most nutritious food, but another way is also just, making your own medicines, just your own remedies. So could you speak to that, what you've done on your farm and just, general advice in that area?
I think Rosemary Gladstar has a really good book on planting a medicinal garden. So we grow a wide variety of what would be considered medicinal plants, echinacea, yarrow, elderberry, our native farmscape. Native farmscape has mullein, plantain, and other things that are just kind of indigenous that we come across. And so we've comfrey, I'm not in,
which one?
Calendula.
Okay.
So there's a wide variety of both annual and perennial medicinal plants that you can grow almost anywhere in North America. And I highly encourage people to grow as many of them as possible. And again, some of them are perennials like comfrey, like elderberries. Some of them are annuals, though they'll self-seed like calendula and echinacea and other flowering plants. And, you know, the other benefit to more medicinal plantings, you know, we also grow lemon balm, catnip, various mints. The other benefit to these plants is generally when we're planning our annual growing, our food production type growing, I allocate roughly 20 to 30% of our square footage to herbs and flowers and other plants. Because that 20 to 30% investment helps immensely with pest and disease issues in our food production side. So you can help your food production be better, get better pollination, get less disease and pest pressure, and you can be growing medicinal stuff at the same time through good garden planning and space usage and planning.
Okay. What about as far as processing these plants with tinctures, you know, just making tinctures for something like echinacea? Just what would your advice be there?
Yeah. You know, the nice thing is tinctures are pretty easy. We generally always keep around quite a few bottles of high proof alcohol for tincture making. And basically, again, there's a lot of good basic books that will teach you how to make basic tinctures out of both fresh and dried plant materials. You just need bottles and you just need basic, you know, tincture making is not that difficult, especially for a lot of common and non-dangerous plants. food dehydrator is a great thing because you can dehydrate plant materials and then use them in teas and in other ways. So especially like your mints, your calendula flowers, your elderberry flowers. There's a lot of medicinal flowers, your rose hips, all of that kind of stuff can be gently dehydrated. Then you can vac pack it if you have vac packing equipment, or you can vac pack it into glass jars, which is my preference, to reduce plastic exposure, and then use those kind of things in teas and other places. Lavender is another medicinal plant you can grow. It's not a plant I grow because I'm deathly allergic to lavender. Mm-hmm. So it makes me like break out in giant boils. So I got to avoid lavender, but it's another one worth mentioning. But there's just so many to choose from.
We were just talking about equipment earlier. You've been running into shortages of the bottles that you use for tinctures. Is this something that's easy to access now, or is it supplies getting tight on it?
You can still get equipment. You can still get glass bottles, glass jars. You're just going to pay more. You know, but there's a lot of bottles and jars out there that from products you buy that you can reuse for this kind of stuff. You know, a lot of people are about to discover why grandma had a basement full of every jar and lid from the past 25 years of shopping.
Right. Yeah. What about it as far as, have you mentioned plantains? You make a poultice with plantains, correct? And if you could talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I'm referring to the green leafy plantain plant, not the banana knockoff.
Right. Banana. Yep. Yep.
So plantain, you can use it for making salves and poultices. You can also just straight up, when you get insect bites or other things, straight up grab a clean leaf, chew it up in your mouth, and then basically make a paste out of it that you apply to insect bites or other type things on your skin. So plantain has a long history for treating such things.
Right. All right. What do you make salves out of for your family?
So we usually have been buying salves. We haven't made too many ourselves yet, though it is on the list. The main salves we keep around are wound treatment salves. So because, you know, we've gone now almost 60 years without ever needing antibiotics for our kids. So we've not once needed antibiotics in 60 total years, roughly, our kids have racked up on this earth. And a lot of that is understanding proper wound care and also having herbal alternatives to treat wounds that were, for whatever reason, were overly dirty, or otherwise the wound got exposed to something that increased the risk of infection. So wound-type salves and burn-type salves are some of the most important to either learn to make or to have some from a good company on hand.
Okay, let's go inside now and talk about preserving foods, different techniques you use. Yeah, you just talked about dehydrating for plants. Yeah, if you could talk about the, just your use of dehydration for food for your family.
Yeah. So I had a really interesting discussion with Ben Falk. He's a permaculture guy, lives up in the Northeast, on how your location shapes your food preservation and what are more sensible ways to do food preservation. Because modern people tend to rely on energy-intensive methods of food preservation. Canning, dehydrating, and freezing. Whereas up until very recently, people focused food preservation on lower energy methods of food preservation. Root cellaring, air drying, collecting nuts and other things in their shells to be cracked later and things like that. So while we do do a small bit of dehydrating, we tend to focus our food preservation on lower energy, higher calorie reward type foods. Fermentation is another low energy food preservation method. You know, so like sweet potatoes, you can grow a couple hundred pounds of sweet potatoes in a very small area. You can cure them. Then you can store them under a bed in some crates in a cool spare room in your house. And that 100 pounds of sweet potatoes is going to have a tremendous amount of calorie value. You know, you can grow garlic and then braid it and hang it and dry it that way and then have garlic all winter. So I'm not against dehydrating. But dehydrating is energy and time intensive for not always a whole lot of calorie yield on the backside. But, you know, we'll make fruit roll-ups on occasion. There's certain fruits we'll dehydrate. We like making, you know, jam making is a pretty decent one where it's, because it's not like, you know, it's not as energy intensive to do certain canned jams and jellies as it is to like fully can low acid vegetables for storage. And you don't have as much nutrition loss either as you do when you're fully, fully canning certain foods. So we use dehydration. We'll on occasion can, though especially when I'm canning foods for preservation, I'm generally focusing on canning full meals. So canning soups, canning stews, or canning meat, where I'm canning something that I have less nutrition loss and more caloric value to recoup the time and energy it takes to can. I've just never really understood canning green beans and a lot of other low-calorie foods that lose so much nutritional value to boot after they first go through the canning process and then they go through the being cooked a second time process. It'd be great to get some data on the nutrition loss and the energy usage of some of these food preservation techniques.
So what are the variations on the shelf life you get, John, with these various food preservation techniques? Is it, yeah, we're talking years for some of these foods, correct?
Yeah. So now the crown jewel of food preservation in terms of nutrient retention and shelf stability is freeze drying. So the only drawback to freeze drying is if you want to do it yourself, it's pretty expensive, but there's now a company that makes and sells home freeze drying equipment, which is incredible. So, but you know, with freeze drying, you have both the cost of freeze drying the things and the equipment to do it, and then also the packaging, because freeze dried stuff has to be vacuum pack sealed, or it'll immediately start to suck moisture back in and then mold and be ruined. But given how expensive freeze-dried food is to purchase, you know, if you're somebody that does or wants to do a great deal of food preservation, investing in a home freeze-drying setup would probably be near the top of my list. So canned foods, as long as they're canned properly and stored properly, they have a fairly good shelf life. 3, 4, 5 years for a lot of home canned items. But again, a lot of those have a tremendous nutritional loss. And after a few years, other than the minerals and the calories, they've had almost a complete nutrient drawdown in storage. So one thing, Chris Masterjohn had some really good articles a few years ago showing that freezing certain vegetables, for instance, after 6 to 12 months of these vegetables being frozen, they had 0% detectable folate. So nutrient drawdown in preserved foods, I think, is an under-discussed issue, that people think they're getting certain nutrients from preserved foods that they're actually not, which is why it's one thing I love about the work of Weston A. Price is he pointed out traditional people that the foods they focused on preserving were generally high calorie root vegetables,
right,
and then high vitamin fats and oils, and then high protein and high mineral and nutrient meats. You know, so you're going to be in a much better position having 500 mixed pounds of potatoes, sweet potatoes, winter squash, and whatever, and then a bunch of lard and a bunch of butter and things, compared to like having a wall of canned vegetables that are low in calories and low in nutrients. Though obviously having both is great because then you still have variety. You know, I don't know if we talked about this in previous audio casts. I'm a really big fan of season extension over food preservation. You know, in a lot of the US, you can grow vegetables year round with a modest investment in a little bit of infrastructure. And that way, you don't have all the time and energy and cost of processing those foods and the nutrition loss that creates. And you're basically storing them in the ground where they retain their most value and benefit to you. So Ray Tyler, really awesome farmer down in Tennessee.
Sure.
Elliot Coleman is another one up in the Northeast of legend. His, I think it's like The Four Season Gardener is the name of his book. So I prefer for food preservation, we have grains, which have been historically preserved. They have a great shelf life. They're easy to store, high in calories. Their nutritional value does not decrease over time if they're left whole instead of milled. I prefer growing and storing root vegetables, squashes, certain plants in the allium family. So storage onions, storage varieties of garlic. And then we'll supplement that core food reserves with some things that we dehydrate, some things that we can, some things that we freeze.
Mm-hmm. For, just people who have a root cellar, what's your recommendation on just the setup of that and, yeah, the particular foods you put in the root cellar?
Well, there's a great book. I think the name is Nancy Buble, called Root Cellaring. And it's the bar none best book. If you're going to have one book on root cellaring, that's the book you probably want to have. At least last time I checked, the book's available. And again, what you store in a root cellar depends on what part of the country you're in, you know, but because root cellars are amazing, because if you have access to storage varieties of apples, you could store apples and carrots and potatoes and just so many different things in a root cellar if you set it up right and if you manage it right. And Buble goes all over, if you have a basement, there's so many easy ways to turn nooks and crannies of your basement into root cellar type space that you can then take advantage of and use. This is a hilarious story. Jessica will probably laugh in the background as I tell this. But when we lived in Louisville, we lived in a two-story apartment at one point. And it was, I think the building was four stories and our apartment was the first story and a walkout type basement story. And the master bedroom was the lower story. So it was completely bermed into this hillside on three sides. So it was cold all the time down in this master bedroom. And the closet off the master bedroom went into the hillside. So the closet was on the hillside side of the bedroom. So the closet was even colder than the rest of the bedroom. And we're a young married couple, and I think I might have still been in school. So we never turned the heat on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just forever cold all the time. And so we have this master bedroom closet. And going into that winter, I purchased probably 200 or 300 pounds of winter squash. And we didn't have a lot of clothes because we're not like high clothing. So we have this giant walk-in master bedroom closet. And we have like not even a third of it with clothing in the closet. And so we turned the closet into a giant root cellar in our apartment in Louisville. And I have, you know, shelves and shelves of butternut squash and spaghetti squash and other squash and potatoes and other things. So people think like you need some sort of special setup to pull this kind of stuff off. And you really just need to be willing to do it and make use of the space you have.
Right. What about, just setting up a larder, a pantry. What are your recommendations for efficient use on that?
So after the audio cast, send me an email. I'll send to you to share with all the Solari subscribers. They are kind of my rough medical kit lists and other supply lists that a ton of people have just found really, really helpful in terms of thinking about, you know, what do you keep on hand and why? What does it look like to have a deep pantry, a deep resource-based build into your house? You know, our basic, again, since we have a grain mill, we generally have on hand anywhere from 300 to 500 pounds of various whole grains, oats, buckwheat, spelt, emmer, einkorn, you know, sky's the limit. So I always tell people, if your concern is really having a high degree of resilience, a grain mill is one of your best investments because grains are easy to store. They're calorie dense if they're properly prepared. They're relatively nourishing. You know, if all you have is a backyard flock of chickens, a bunch of stored up lard and butter, and some various grains, if all you had were eggs to eat every day with some good fats and some good grains, you could go quite a long distance on that and stay pretty healthy. So, grains are one of the things we have. Good fats are another one of the things we have. We always keep a certain amount of nut butters in our deep pantry, our larder. Nut butters are a double-edged sword because they're really high in polyunsaturated fatty acids. So I don't encourage people to build an emergency food plan around nut butters, because even though they're very calorie dense and even though they're very fat dense, they're very filling, consumed in excess for long periods of time, they're going to contribute to other problems. So yes, you won't starve. Instead, you're going to have something, you know, even possibly worse happen to you. So we have nut butters. We have quite a bit of dehydrated fruits. So dates are absolutely one of my favorite dehydrated fruits to have in a deep pantry, because dates are just so rich in vitamins and minerals and nutrients. So dates are another thing. Whole nuts, like almonds and stuff, are another great thing to supplement into a deep pantry. You know, we have 2 chest freezers. So we normally have at least 400 to 500 pounds of frozen meat and some frozen fruit on hand.
Mm-hmm.
The frozen fruit does not last that long, because even if we have 30 pounds of frozen fruit with a family of 8, if we spread that out, it maybe lasts us 45 days. But again, fruit isn't something I'm too worried about having constant access to, because historically speaking, people farther north did not have constant access to it. You know, so we generally over winter, most years, have tucked away in every nook and cranny of the house piles of potatoes, piles of sweet potatoes, piles of winter squash, milk crates full of garlic.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have bins of onions, all kinds of stuff like that. And I'm trying to think other foods that we, you know, I do keep a limited amount of, again, easily canned soups or canned meats. There's a great company out of Ohio. I'll let you share this company name later, because last I checked, they were really badly backordered. And I don't want them getting hit with a whole bunch of orders and Daryl yelling at me being like,
you know, right, sure.
But they are one of the few providers of pastured canned beef and other high quality canned protein. So we have a number of cases of canned beef from them for emergencies. We basically try and have enough various foodstuffs that we could get through 3 to 6 months with limited resupplying.
Right. So you mentioned the grain mill as one tool. You know, a lot of people just really rely on like a handheld blender. Is that something you use as pretty regular basis in processing food?
Well, we use a handheld blender for making soups and smoothies, but that's about all.
Okay.
There are some higher grade blenders where there's an author by the name of Sue Gregg. Sue is actually who told us about Sally Fallon and how we got into Weston A. Price type stuff. But she had an entire book on preparing whole grains with nothing but a really good blender. So it was like blender batter muffins, blender batter pancakes, blender batter waffles, all kinds of, really getting the most out of a high grade blender by grinding up grains thoroughly in the blender because they're in with liquid. So that was a super cool book that kind of shaped some of our thinking years ago, but it's hard to replace a grain mill.
Right. For most of the storage on grains, do you keep it in plastic buckets? Is that how?
Yeah, 5-gallon buckets. It's simple. Abby is lamenting in the background that her closet is basically like our extended pantry.
Okay, your grain supply goes there.
Well, not just grain supply, but there's, we'll keep some dried pasta on hand, especially quinoa pasta. And, you know, we keep applesauce would be another thing in a deep pantry if, you know, just so that we have a fruit option and to get some of those nutrients fruit does supply. So we normally keep multiple cases of applesauce on hand. We'll keep some cases of good quality, all fruit, you know, no sugar added, organic fruit spreads. Or again, that's something you can make yourself. You can, you know, do your own jams and jellies and whatnot. You know, but the big thing, anytime I talk about food preparedness and food preservation, you have to store things you and your family actually eat. This was the biggest weakness of the original CSA model. So people would buy shares to get vegetable boxes from farms.
Right.
And the farmer would send them a box of stuff and half of it they wouldn't eat.
Yes.
And farmers started to give recipes and that made it so then there was like a third of the stuff people wouldn't eat. But like, I'm never going to like kohlrabi. I don't care if you love kohlrabi, but I'm never going to eat kohlrabi. Hey, you know what? That's way enough wood in the fire. It's getting warmer, not colder outside. So let's not turn the house into Florida. So like I see people when they're doing food, you know, they're worried about food shortages next year. So they go to this online company and they buy their 2-year food preparedness package. And I'm just like, have you ever ate half of the things in this food preparedness package?
Like, right.
I'm like, do you really think your children are not going to mutiny on you when you try and feed them this stuff? Like that's not a prudent approach to building food resilience into your world.
I noticed the same before COVID hit. I just noticed a lot of the CSAs I was familiar with had just gone down in business. They had just their number of subscribers had shrunk. So I don't know. I mean, what do you see with that kind of model now? Is that because it did make a comeback last year? Is it settling or is it declining again? Or do you see some resilience for it where that kind of model can continue on?
I think it varies on the part of the country and the smarts of the farmer. Like a lot of farmers realized they could do a successful CSA by building in choice.
Right.
And giving people, you know, so basically instead of the farmer deciding what people ate, the people get to decide. So it's much more like a build a box type service. One of the interesting things about people, this is what Trader Joe's has done so well. If you give people too many choices, it overwhelms them and they make no choice at all. And if you give people no choices, they really dislike it. So you want to give people just enough choices to where they feel they have an investment and some ownership without ending up with what's known as decision fatigue.
Right.
So farmers who have kind of mastered that area of behavioral economics are generally doing well. Whereas farmers who err too far on the other sides of that, too much choice or too little choice, tend to continue to struggle.
Right. All right. Well, now we're going to go take a look at creating a business out of your homestead operation. I mean, I worked with a number of people over the years who had a family cow. We're getting too much milk from the cow and we're looking for an outlet for it. So they might have started up a cow share agreement, something like that. But we'll get into what happened with your family a little later. But just in general, what's your advice on people who are looking to convert their homestead operation into some type of business to at least help, you know, recoup some of the money spent on it?
Yeah. So on my Telegram channel, I'm doing a whole series right now on this whole topic, not just applied to homestead, but with so many people wanting to transition out of working for bad companies or wanting to start working for themselves and stuff. I have an entire series of audio things I'm recording for my Telegram channel that might interest some of the Solari folks. You know, basically for a homestead, there has never been more ways to monetize your homestead. obviously a homestead generally lends itself to one of, you know, three or four types of endeavors. The first one makes the most sense. It's selling some of the excess of what the homestead produces.
Right.
Selling vegetables, selling eggs. If you're going to raise two pigs for your family, raise six pigs total to defray costs and whatnot. Not going to really add too much to that particular one, since it's the one most people are most familiar with. And it's the one that there's probably the most writings about. So then the second, you know, one is basically value adding onto what your homestead produces, or doing a value added enterprise as part of your homestead. So for us, that's our elderberry syrup business. You know, I know people who do salsas. I know people who do herb and spice blends. They primarily grow herbs and spices on their homestead, and then they value add those by making dried herb and spice blends that they sell. I always tell people value added processing is where actual money is to be found. You know, think about a pig. If you have a pig right now, say you have a 220 to 240 pound pig, how much money will you get for that pig if you take it to the auction house?
Not much.
Yeah. You're going to get $30 maybe on a 240 pound pig. Okay. So then let's say you sell that pig, you sell it live to a local customer who wants a whole or a half of a hog. That pig that you got $30 for now, how much can you get for roughly?
Maybe about $1,000, right?
I'd say $600 to $800. Depends.
Okay.
Because it's only a 200, 220 pound pig. You might be able to get $3 a pound live weight. But it's 20 to 30 times more than what you would have gotten at the auction barn. So then let's say you get the pig butchered and you sell it by the cut. So you're going to sell bacon and you're going to sell hams and you're going to sell shoulder roast and you're going to sell the different cuts of the pig. How much money could you get out of that pig now?
I'd say $1,500 easy, right? If not more.
Maybe. But the problem you run into is it's so much more time and labor to sell by the cut. And you have to have access to a USDA facility.
Right.
But now, take that same pig. Oh, and the reason you might not make much more than if you just sold the whole animal is, right now at a place like Walmart or Kroger, how much can you buy a pork shoulder roast for when it's on sale? It's less than $1 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
So when you begin to sell cuts of meat in my area around Louisville, the wholesale price for like Boston butt and pork shoulder roasts directly from really good farms is like $2.50 or $3 a pound.
Ooh, that's too, yeah. They're not getting value.
So consumers have a certain price tolerance. Consumers just aren't going to pay six times the price of something at Kroger generally. Now, yes, there's a small percentage of consumers who will pay a six-fold premium, but there's not that many. So now take that same pig and turn it into nothing but value-added cuts. You turn the jowl into jowl bacon. You turn all of the hams and all of the roasts into various linked sausages. you turn the pork chops into Canadian bacon. You just turn that pig into $2,000 or more. And you're only having to handle and move a limited selection of cuts. And the price differential between your product and Kroger or Costco is much smaller or none at all. You're like, how much is a good quality breakfast sausage at Kroger? It's like $6 to $8 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're charging $8 or $9 a pound for your breakfast sausage, it's not a hard sell because there's not this massive price discrepancy. Because in the value added world is where the money is and where the margin is and where you can actually compete. You can compete in spice blends. You can compete in all of these value added things. You can't compete with commodities. And then take it one step further, just get your pig or your cow totally turned into like beef sticks and jerky. You just turn that pig into an over $3,000 product if you push it all into pastured pork sticks, which is what John Arbuckle of Rome Stick.
Right.
We sell the vegetables we mainly sell are, if we're selling just straight vegetables, are the vegetables that have a high margin. We don't sell potatoes. We don't raise potatoes to sell potatoes. Because you can go to Costco and get a 20-pound bag of organic potatoes for like $18. There's just no margin there. There's no value-added proposition. You can't make anything back on your time and land growing potatoes for the most part. But cherry tomatoes, you can make money on cherry tomatoes or salad mix because these are viewed as value-added type products. So you can make money selling straight up vegetables and stuff or things your farm produce. You can especially make money on the value-added side of those things. The third area you can really make money on a homestead is through experiences.
Right.
I know a homesteader who plants an amazing flower area every year. And then people come to take pictures in the flower area because it's just amazing. And they partnered with a local photographer. And, you know, they get like, you know, the photographer does six shooting sessions a day at $50 to the homestead per session in this beautiful flower area. So they're basically making almost $600 every day. There's the photo shoots of passive income. I know another farmer put in a number of hip camp locations on their farm. And the hip camp locations are generating like $20,000, $30,000 a year in income on $15,000 upfront investment. So they basically completely recouped the investment in the first 6 months. And now their hip camp locations are all profit.
Mm-hmm.
You could do on homestead education. We do so many classes on our homestead every year. And we could do so many more if I had the time. But people will pay, you know, $70 to come and learn good garden design principles, learn how to butcher chickens, learn how to bake, you know, traditional sourdough bread. So this area of education and experience is another value-added area that people will pay for. You try and sell your cucumbers for more than $1 a cucumber, it's going to be hard. But you can sell a 4-hour on-farm class that ends with a meal, or somebody walks home with a chicken that they butchered for $100.
Right.
You can get people to show up to that class. And you just made $2,000 in a single Saturday instead of trying to sell 2,000 cucumbers.
Right. Yeah, we see the states promoting agritourism more state. This is what you're seeing on the homestead operations now. It's just the growth of these agritourism type activities.
Oh, yeah. Agritourism. Oh, you know, like if your farm has a good barn, it's like where we did the Rogue Food Conference in Tennessee.
Right.
It was a horse farm that didn't make any financial sense. And they turned it into a beautiful event venue. And that event venue, if it wasn't for all the stupidity, would probably be booked 200 to 300 days a year and bringing in over $500,000 a year as an event venue to do weddings, birthday parties, company gatherings, just whatever.
Right.
And again, people will pay for a value-added product, for a value-added experience. And that's where the money really is. You know, there's all sorts of other ways to recoup money on a homestead. You know, if you have woodland, manage the woodland well. You're going to have marketable timber, especially if you plant the right species of wood. We had a small area that was primarily walnut trees. And this area of walnut trees, the trees weren't doing super well. So I had these walnut trees logged off a couple years ago. And you know, maybe 8 or 9 walnut trees fetched over $4,000 as marketable timber.
Mm.
Just incredible. I'm like, I should be planting walnut trees for my grandkids because they'll be millionaires off the wood. So there's so many different ways. And again, you know, just so many different ways you could go with it. But in order to do it successfully, and this is something I'm going to cover on my Telegram channel, you have to understand the three circles, I call them. And the first circle is your interests and your skill set and your resources. The second circle is your land and infrastructure. And the third circle is your market. And all of those circles where they make that beautiful Venn diagram and all three circles overlap is where you have enterprises with a high degree of likelihood of success. Because it doesn't matter if you have a market for grass-fed beef, if you have 7 acres.
Right.
And no expanding cattle. It doesn't matter if you have a market, if your skill set and your resources won't let you meet that market. And at the same time, it doesn't matter if you're interested in basket weaving and your farm would produce all of the material you need for making old-fashioned baskets to weave if nobody wants to buy hand-woven baskets. So when you're thinking through choosing an enterprise for your homestead, you need to think through these three circles and find enterprises that hit that sweet spot in the bullseye where all three circles overlap.
Let's talk about Abby's Elderberry, just your own experience, how you wound up getting into the business and how it evolved once you're up and running.
Yeah. So we planted elderberries on our homestead around 7 or 8 years ago now. And I guess it was around, was it 2018, Abby? I had you start making elderberry, probably, or 17. So we noticed there is interest in elderberry syrup. And one of the things we require of all of our kids is by the time they reach about 10 years old, we provide like basic room and board. But as Joel Salatin says, nobody gets paid for breathing. And so by the time they reach 10 years old, they're required to have their own small business as part of the homestead. And Abby's first business was doing pullet chickens for people who wanted not to raise chickens from chicks, but to buy chickens that would be laying eggs soon without having to raise them from the chick stage to the laying stage.
Right.
We just had too much predator pressure for that. And it was too much of a pain on a lot of levels, meeting people, taking them chickens. So I saw there's this interest in this elderberry product. We grow elderberries. We have a lot of wild elderberries all around our farm. So she started making elderberry syrup. And I was speaking at a conference, and they asked me a few months before I was going to speak. And they're like, hey, what do you want to speak about at the conference? I was like, you know, this is how I come up with what books I want to write. I pitch talk ideas, and then I see how many people show up for the talk and how they respond to the talk. So they has like, I'd really like to give a talk about elderberry at this conference, if you'll let me give a talk about elderberry. And I gave the talk, and it was standing room only. And people were just rapt with attention.
Was this Mother Earth News, John?
Yeah, I was at one of the Mother Earth News fairs.
Okay.
So I immediately started writing a book on elderberry. And we invested in growing the elderberry business in terms of investing in more equipment, investing in nicer labels, just the whole nine yards. And that's how we ended up with a moderately successful elderberry business as part of our homestead.
Right. How was it just getting, because I think eventually you had to get some kind of licensing to get that. Yeah. So if you could describe that, because that's never easy.
Yeah. So our local inspector, thankfully, is a good and reasonable person in a wicked and unreasonable state. The biggest problem you might have with a homestead, and this is why I love the work for Institute for Justice and what they've been doing to constantly expand cottage food laws.
Right.
Is another thing to consider when you're looking at possible homestead enterprises is which ones does your state actually allow you to do out of your homestead? And if you can't do something out of your homestead, what does your access and cost to a certified kitchen look like? Because in some parts of the country, it could be $40 an hour to use a certified kitchen. And then you have your licensing and other things you have to do to be able to use the certified kitchen. So these are other questions you have to navigate as you're thinking through some of these issues and decisions. So ours wasn't terrible because our inspector is good and the license is a pain in the butt. And I actually need to sometime in the next few days go and pay our renewal of $150. But it's one reason you want to look for products where you'll have the margin to absorb some of the compliance costs to be able to do them.
Right.
But it's unpleasant.
Yeah. What Institute for Justice has done is these types of sales used to be just mainly direct to consumer. And what they've tried to do is to expand them to retail stores within the producer state, you know, without any licensing requirements. And they've gotten bills passed in several states like that. So I think it's, yeah, just a potential boon depending on where you are for the homesteaders.
IJ does great work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I think with all this mess in the conventional food system right now, just one thing I think you're looking at is just a further deregulation of locally produced food. So it's, yeah, there's some real opportunities, I think, that are going to be coming up.
Yeah. Here's to hoping.
Yeah. Well, I know. Well, there was
never waste a crisis.
No. Well, that
in a good way, that's what we need to do.
Well, that's right. Yeah. You do quite a bit of consulting with homesteaders around the country. So do you just see a pickup in demand, I guess, especially since the beginning of the year, where it's becoming more and more apparent that the conventional food system is in big trouble right now?
Yeah, well, it's not just the food system.
Well, it's everything. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people just realize the United States is in trouble. I mean, they understand that, you know, Solari, I think some of the quarterly volumes they put out has touched on the unsustainable monetary policy. We have a lot of foundational structural problems in the United States. Unsound currency, run amok money printing, consolidation of wealth in the hands of the well-connected, a run amok, lawless regulatory state. We're beginning to see some real regional balkanization with like what's going on in Florida, what's going on in Tennessee, what's going on in Texas versus what's going on in California, New York, you know, the Pacific Northwest. So anybody who pays attention to things other than like Justin Bieber's haircut and, you know, like people who actually pay attention to things that matter, you know, they're looking around and just realizing like, oh crap. Like I need to be taking active steps to mitigate risk and to position myself and my family to weather the coming possible hurricane that is going to rock the United States at some point. And so, yeah, my consulting, I think I'm up to a dozen people on my wait list for consulting visits over the next 2 months, you know, because they're wanting advisement for where to buy land, what type of land to buy, what kind of infrastructure to put on the land, how to do design work on the land. Some of them are hiring me just to take care of building out their deep pantry because they're just, you know, somebody who makes a lot of money and they're just like, I don't want you to give me a checklist. I want you just to build me a deep pantry because I don't got time for that. So, you know, but lots of people are trying to get ahead of the curve of, you know, these supply chain and other issues. And the media coverage has just been crazy. I could email you news articles where the media is saying things like empty shelves are a good thing. Inflation is a good thing. Not being able to buy the things you want to buy is actually a good thing.
Right.
We're like straight out, we're somewhere between like, you know, 1984 and Atlas Shrugged at the moment.
Yeah, well, the media has just lost so much credibility now. I think, yeah, what you're going to see, hopefully we'll see, is just a local model, just more of a merge between local currencies, locally produced food, and just try as much of a push out of the conventional system as possible right now. Because it's, yeah, there's just the food quality is worse in the conventional system. I mean, these people in the pharma want you to get booster shots the rest of your life. Yeah, it's just madness right now. And
yeah,
I think that's what, yeah, just rogue food is partly about, is finding these local models that work and enable people to make it easier to get out of the conventional system.
Yeah.
But
yep. I'm so excited for rogue food in Florida.
Yeah.
One is I'm just excited to go to the beach again.
Well, yeah, we'll have some weather for you by then. No worries. But all right. Well, John, can people, just email you any questions you have? I mean, you were gracious enough to do it last couple audio casts. Is it okay if they, just contact you through Solaris?
Yeah, if people want to reach out to me, they can find me on social. You know, if Solari Audiocast listeners want to send you a bunch of follow-up stuff, if there's enough content at some point to do another follow-up episode, we can, you know, sit back down and chat over things for folks. You can find me on social media until I get banned again.
Right. Well, you're still on Facebook, right? Or have you been banned?
No, I'm for the moment. So, but I've started using Telegram and a few other places.
Yeah, much better.
And, you know, I mainly keep my Facebook a little bit less offensive to the powers that be for the time being.
Right. Yeah, Telegram's like drinking from a fire hose compared with all the censorship on Facebook. So.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. So.
Yep. But all right. Well, yeah, just many thanks for your time and take care.
Great. Thanks, Pete. It's the best to you and your family and to all the folks at Solari.
Likewise. See you.